Haide, musa mei fili, molpis demis catarhu.
Poetry on the radio. Poetry in and around the ACT. Today we conclude our long conversation with multi-genre writer Subhash Jyrath. Plus, the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news and events from the Canberra region. For ArtSound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles. Our guest today on Poetry on the Radio, as for the last 2 weeks, is Subhash Jyrath, one of the most accomplished writers ever to work in the ACT. At the end of last week's episode, Subhash Jyrath was speaking about the evils of violence and how they shaped his vision of the death by self-immolation of a young Buddhist monk who had witnessed his mother murdered by Chinese soldiers. Here he reads three sections of the poem, which ends his book Aflame, published in 2021 by Gazebo Books under its Life Before Man imprint.
The milk in the bowl my mother holds is red with blood. With blood from the wound in her head. The wound from the bullet. The soldier shoots, he shoots, he shoots. I watch him shoot. Each time I shut my eyes, he shoots. His head is turned away, his eyes unseen. His heart beats, I hear it beat. And beat. Each time I shut my eyes, he shoots, the blood trickles, it drops in the bowl, stains the milk saffron red, the blood of my mother. The blood of my mother, I drink and I drink the milk, stained with my mother's blood. The bowl she held when the bullet hit her. The bowl breaks, it breaks into pieces I gather in my dream to hold the bowl from which I drink and drink. She didn't scream, just fell near the dead goat she called Amba, the goddess of milk and butter, the one she milked. And I milked too. I milk her in my dream. And the soldier shoots. He shoots and shoots in my dream. Don't ask, I tell my mind in hope that it will make the body forget any thought of food. Its smell, taste, and its promise to bring pleasure and accept the ordeal of fasting we have to endure for 2 more days and 2 more sleeps unslept, watched by Dhruvatara, the polar star, and its companions, the 7 serene sages, seated around it in a bright celestial boat. That's where I would be, my mother often said, putting me to bed with stories for me to dream. And Amba too, of course, Dorji, you silly little boy, says my mother, and kisses my eyes and my ice-cold chin with the crescent scar I touch and rub to forget the hunger I fight with. Determined not to give in, and walk counting steps. Shiknye Sung, 1, 2, 3, Gigu Chu, 8, 9, 10, and pause at 77. That number that looks like 2 swans floating in a pond. He stands near the entrance of the cave, stands with his dove hands aglow, ready to light up my mind, the mind that has lost its poise, its flow, safe and steady, ready to rebel, to fight, Abhaya, the fearlessness. Don't the smile speaks, don't the eyes call, don't the palms gesture, don't give up now. The hope, and I look and look, his right hand raised to the height of his shoulder, his arms bent, the palms spread open, erect outward, the fingers upright, joined together, assured, certain. The left arm hanging down, touching the body, its open palm, a lotus petal, a flesh of bliss, tranquil. Fear not, Dorji. Fear not, I hear my mother whisper. Her face etched on the palm flickers like the wick in a lamp. I know, I know, I want to say I know, but my lips seem stitched, the throat choked, and the tongue tied, dead like Amba the goat, shot by the soldier with a cigarette in his mouth. And the fear, I fear, returns, tied like a noose round my neck. It's the fear. It's the fear thing which creates all sorts of violence. It's the fear. It's the fear through which Stalin ruled. It's the fear.
The way that poem, the effect that it has, really, this doesn't happen very often where you're reading something and then you realize you've slipped somewhere else. And you're in this different place, akin, but not the same place. And that happens to me with this poem, both when I read it and the poems, the series, and when you read it. If I had to say it, what this poem is about, and that's absolutely the wrong word, but I would say ultimately it's a petition for forgiveness. And that... I think the repetition of the language, the certain words that are used over and over, mother, goat, cigarette, soldier, fear, finch, crow, these are the words that you've drawn to create this other place. One word can have that moment, right? The inside? But then if you get a few of them arranged and then they're working together, like that much more powerful. I don't know if this makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense. In essay about Hiromi Ito in the book Spinoza's Overcoat, I mention, and this is a very idiosyncratic way of my way. I am not an academic. I don't teach poetry because I rightly or wrongly believe that poetry can't be taught. And you can teach the craft, but you can't make a poet. And I relate in an essay in Celan's Voice, where one of his readers sends him a poem. And he looks at the poem written on a page, and he says, "What? 300, 400 words on one A4 sheet of paper? What's the use?" And he says, and it's imagined. I don't know whether it happened or not. I have imagined that. So then he takes that poem, works on it, and reduces it to 20 words. And then he says, I didn't send him my 20 words poem because I don't want to offend him. Time will come, he'll learn that less is always better. And then I say in the Hiromi Ito's essay on Hiromi Ito that there are two types of poets. One I call as sculptors, like, say, Michelangelo working, standing in front of the slab of marble. So he chisels and chisels, and out of the big slab, he just keeps the shape which will work. So he works like a sculptor. He just gets rid of all the extra material, stoniness. So that's one. There are poets who work like sculptors. And there are poets who work like painters, like Hiromi Ito. Her poetry is very powerful. I think it's just. And the way she reads it, it's one. I have heard her in one of the Poetry on the Move festival. It was spellbounding. And her poetry is wonderful. And the effect she captures is by repeating the words. So she's like a painter putting paint dabs on the canvas again and again, layer after layer, layer after layer. That's another style of poem. I don't know which is good or which is bad. The goodness or badness is based on what effect it creates. And they create the same effect. Mm-hmm. Celan with his 20 words and Hiromi Ito with her 400 words. It's the thing is the effect, how the words affect you, creates an emotion. That's the beauty of it.
There's a quote that has been attributed to William Stafford, but I can't find it. But it says, language can do what it can't say. And I think that's what you're describing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I say, one last sort of idiosyncratic idea. Linguists will break the language into phonemes, sentences, phrases. But other philosophers like Mikhail Bakhtin will say they are not phrases or phonemes or sentences, they are utterances. And the difference between phrase and utterances is utterance is something uttered by someone, spoken by someone. Even the written word was spoken by someone. And that's why he says, in each word you find the sounds of the spokenness of the words. Words are not like dead butterflies in a dictionary. No, they become words when they are spoken. Right, and when you—that's the beauty of utterance. When you utter, Bakhtin says, you put all your emotions into it, your intent into it, your being human into it. The phrase doesn't capture that. That's why the written word never captures the human intent and emotions.
What you're talking about, in a sense, is words as being all speech acts. They all make something happen.
Yeah, in a presentation of a play in the street theater, Crime and Punishment, I was invited to participate in a panel discussion about the novel and its idea. And I introduced my comment by saying I'm going to say something very blasphemous. And it's a 450 pages book. I said the whole book can be reduced to two lines. Can be two lines. And that's a conversation between Sonia and Raskolnikov. Raskolnikov, the murderer, and Sonia, his savior, the woman who loves him. And she asks Raskolnikov, why did you kill the pawnbroker and her sister? Why did you? And his line is this, I didn't kill her. I killed a vermin. She was a vermin. And vermin is wash in Russian. And Sonia's answer is, she's shattered by that. And her answer in Russian is, Это человек-то вош, which in translation means this human being, a vermin. And there is a Russian word человек-то. Человек is human, and there is a hyphen and та. Та cannot be translated. And in the print, Dostoevsky puts an exclamation mark. And I would put not one exclamation mark, 10 exclamation marks and 10 question marks. Because that little word, the, and I have explored many translations, no translation captures that small word, the, человек, the. And that's what I said. See, the beauty is, and I said, I ended my remark by saying that, the beauty is that it all depends how the actor performing Sonia will capture that word and express it with her body. It's emotions can only be expressed by body. She can express it. That's the beauty of it. The idea is to explain to the actor the importance of that little the word, phoneme, little word. But it's an utterance. Yeah. It is uttered by Sonia. Yeah. And when you read the Russian film, Crime and Punishment, you can see Sonia, how she speaks that word. And you get the holy sense. How can you call a person a vermin? Hitler called the Jews vermin. And once you call someone vermin, it's easy to kill. Stalin did the same. That's what it is. When you destroy the preciousness, the indelible, inalienable preciousness of human being, that's what the philosopher Raymond Geta says. He doesn't use the word sacredness, the inalienable preciousness of human being, then you can do anything with that.
You're speaking about Russia, brings to mind something that perhaps we can end on is, it's a very banal matter given what you've spoken about, but you were born in India, you did live in Russia, and you ended up in Canberra. Can you briefly tell us how that happened?
Sheer luck, I think. Sheer luck. I was 18, and I come from a very poor family in India. And the one thing our parents did was to give our three brothers best possible education. And I got a scholarship. I had started a degree in a university, degree in physics. Then I applied for a scholarship and I got a scholarship to go to Russia for 5 years to do a course. And I became a geologist. And always people ask me, oh, why did you become a geologist? I said, simple mathematics. I looked at the ad. Most number of positions were for, they select 12 positions all over India to be sent to Soviet Union, Moscow at the time. So I said, my chances of getting a scholarship are more because there are more positions there. And so luckily I got that scholarship and I went to Russia, finished my geology degree, then finished my PhD there. I spent more than 9 years there, and perhaps the best part of my life there. So it changed me altogether. So that's why it makes me very sad, the war going on between Russia and Ukraine. I think, and I write about that war in my essay in George Orwell's Elephant. There is an essay called Joseph Stalin's Metro, the metro in Moscow, and I tell the story of the construction of metro, and there I talk about two stations. And you must have seen the photos where lots of Ukrainians living in Kyiv. And I have been to Kyiv many times. And they were taking shelter in the metro station, Kyiv metro station. And lots of stations in Moscow metro were used during the war as bomb shelters. And so was the station Maikovskaya. So I talk about how they are feeling now, hiding, because their ancestors, who perhaps were also living in Russia, some of them, must be hiding from the German bombs, Nazi bombs, in the shelters. So, and how can the two cultures so close together start killing each other, especially Russians? And one of the friends in that essay, Igor, his father was Russian and mother Ukrainian. So that's what it is. And fear and nationalism, they are the most dangerous combinations. They destroy the whole fabric of society.
And so did you come to Australia as a geologist then, did you, to Canberra?
I went back to India. I taught geology in a university there. And then I got a fellowship to come to Canberra and came in 1986. And I'm here now. So.
To finish our three episodes of Poetry on the Radio with Subhash Jireth, we asked him to read one of his prose poems, In the Beginning There Was the Apple, which is the first piece in Subhash Jireth's 2021 book, Aflame.
I call prose poems as proems, because calling prose poems means they are not poems, they are. So I said, Owen Bullock, my friend, I suggested, why don't you call them proems? He liked the idea, but
hasn't caught on.
So this is the first poem of this series called Moscow 1974. And Phil very kindly printed it the way I wanted, The first line is on one page and the rest of the poem is on another page. In the beginning there was the apple, and the apple was red, stained by the kiss of Tamriko's lips. "Go," she said, "handing me the apple, go, you idiot. You know that I'll wait for you." And so I walked with the apple tucked inside the pocket of my parka. The night was raven black, streaked by the shy light of a two-day moon, veiled by cold mist. I shivered, the apple was warm, its roundness soft like the touch of hope. It kept me awake. But was I truly awake? Was the city I saw that night nothing but an apparition, a walk in which each step I took wiped the traces of steps left behind? But the apple, like Ariadne's ball, spurred me on, unstringing stories to remember and forget. 2 days later, I returned the apple. It was uneaten, but for a bite of the skin and flesh, where Tamriko's lips had left the kiss. I'll read the last poem, because it tells everything about whatever I have written. The autumn this year is glorious. If this is to compensate for your absence, I wanted to return to the restrained beauty of yesteryears. Each day I take the metro to Kalaminskaya to sketch churches and izbas, the same places I had sketched a year earlier when you were with me. I have now finished 3 pairs of with you and without you landscapes. I look at them and can't decide which of the two appeases me more. In a recent dream, I saw you walk in and out of the sketched landscape with such ease that it felt as if in my dream they were not drawings, but real, natural landscapes. And I heard your violin, not Schubert, but Bach. The same chaconne you played once in the shadow of Pushkin, one late, very late night. Just a coincidence, you would have said. Yes, a coincidence it was. No more words, I warn myself. No compulsion to remember or forget. Let the unsaid remain unasked, untranslated, untouched.
Subhash Jairath. He has been our guest on this and the previous 2 episodes of Poetry on the Radio. Next week, our guest will be John Fulcher. For ArtSound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. At Smith's Alternative in Civic on Monday, February 17, 7 p.m, Sarah Wiley, whose work has appeared in the 2023 Paul Cave Prize for Literature Collection and the 2024 Listen Anthology, appears with Juan Garrido Salgado, who has published 8 books of poetry in Australia and Chile. His collections include Hope Blossoming in Their Ink, 2020, and The Dilemma of Writing Poems, 2023, both from Punter and Wattman. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.